This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Survival. That's what's at stake for the Labour Party. First they try and enter the party, then they destroy it in order then to try and advance the revolution. We've got a considerable number of people swarming into the party, and they, as Tom Watson said, are being manipulated by fairly small but very effective hard-left Trotskyist groups.
The T word, as used by a veteran member of the Labour Party right, MP John Speller. But is Mr. Speller correct, as Marxists say? Who are these Trotskyists? How many of them are there? And what do they believe? Step into the briefing room, where, under a portrait of the goateed, long-dead Russian revolutionary, we'll try and find out. But first, who was Leon Trotsky?
One of the reasons that Trotsky was so attractive a figure is that he is this unusual combination of the man of ideas and the man of action. Really one of the most charismatic revolutionaries of the 20th century.
Bertrand M. Patenaude is a biographer of Trotsky and lecturer at Stanford University in California. He agreed to help us chart the revolutionary's life and explain his enduring appeal.
The great what-if of Soviet history. What if Trotsky, the great cosmopolitan, internationalist, intellectual, had come to lead the Soviet Union instead of the backward, autocratic, dictatorial Stalin? For a lot of these people, Trotsky represents the true ideals of October that were never really tried out because Stalin had hijacked the revolution.
In October 1917, alongside Vladimir Lenin, the leader of the Bolshevik Party, Trotsky organized a socialist seizure of power.
He does this through whirlwind organization. As an orator, he's tireless, working up crowds of workers into enthusiasm, if not hysteria. And as Lenin later said, power lay in the streets, and we picked it up.
Comrades! The revolution of workers and peasants has been achieved. The abolition of the aristocracy's ownership of the land, workers' control over the means of production, and the installation of a Soviet government, this cause has been won.
Trotsky believed that for the new workers' state to survive in a capitalist world, revolutions in other countries had to follow. Stalin thought his ideas utopian and wanted to focus on Russia first. Socialism in one country, it was called. Stalin won. As something of an unclubbable outsider, having spent much of his life in Western Europe, Trotsky was outmaneuvered by his fellow revolutionary.
Further, Trotsky begins to call for greater democracy. Now, this strikes a lot of people as hypocritical. He, after all, endorsed Lenin's idea of the tight-fisted party. But when he was being defeated by Stalin in the 1920s, he becomes an advocate of so-called workers' democracy within the party. It's too late. Trotsky is ousted from the party. And in January 1929, Stalin has him exiled from the USSR. Trotsky will never return to Russia again.
Moscow, capital of Soviet Russia, is the scene of another dramatic trial in which world interest is being taken. It is alleged that Trotsky, the unseen prisoner in the dock, At present living in Norway, is the mastermind behind a great plot to smash up the Soviet regime. And at least one witness has declared that it was proposed to assassinate Stalin during this year's May Day parade.
Lenin's old comrades accused of treason, conspiracy, assassination, sabotage, and Trotsky is portrayed as the mastermind acting in exile.
He is convicted in absentia again and again and again. The Norwegian government asks him to leave.
Esteemed audience, you will easily understand if I begin my short address to you in my very imperfect English by addressing my warm thanks to the Mexican people and to the man who leads them with such merit and courage, President Cardenas.
The only country that would take Trotsky in is Mexico. And that's where a Stalinist agent wielding a pickaxe murders Trotsky in his study. It was a mountaineer's axe or ice axe, not an ice pick. But nonetheless, it makes for quite a violent and dramatic exit. When he's defeated by the political machine that he helps to build, he's seen as a classical tragic figure, someone who created the political monster that then destroyed him.
Bertrand Patenaude, that was Trotsky. But who, 76 years later, are the ists? In the briefing room, I'm now joined by John Callaghan, a professor at Salford University, who wrote his PhD on Trotskyism back in the 70s and has continued to chart Trotskyist movements ever since. Also, Amy Leather, the joint national secretary of the Socialist Workers' Party, which describes itself as Trotskyist, and journalist Michael Crick. Amy Leather, Trotsky's been dead a long time. What does it mean to be a Trotskyist today?
Well, I think the starting point is Trotsky was a socialist. He wanted an alternative to the barbarity of capitalism, and he was committed to the idea of fighting for socialism from below, and that's the idea that ordinary working class people can bring about change through their own actions. And Trotsky understood this, not because he had some, I don't know, romantic notion that ordinary people or workers are just going to rise up, but it was an understanding of the system, a system driven by profit, so that's capitalism, but actually those profits being made by ordinary people across the world, who when they stop work, nothing gets done, the profits don't get made for those at the top. It's a potential power that he saw. Now, I say that because we in the SWP, the Socialist Worker Party, we stand in that tradition of change from below. So we have a bigger vision of socialism. It's of ordinary people running society, making decisions, more democracy in that way. But what that means is it's not for us today just to wait until there's a revolution and this all happens. It actually influences what we do now because there's crucial battles now that influence what life is like. And our orientation, therefore, is not just on elections, but actually on what happens in strikes, in workplaces, in protests on the street. For example, next week, if the junior doctors were out on strike, which they were going to be, we'd be the people down on their picket lines, showing them support, raising solidarity collections for them, getting other trade unionists down.
So do you actually have a programme by which you would plan to progress from the current situation to a socialist society?
It's about how do a small group of revolutionaries relate to much larger numbers of people. And Trotsky developed something called the United Front, which was about how people could work together over particular issues where there was agreement. And so for us, whether it's against the war or against the rise of racism, we can work with much larger numbers of people to affect change in the here and now, but actually engage in discussions about potentially bigger change as well.
So by taking part in what you call current struggles, the idea is also to draw people into an appreciation of the need for a complete revolutionary change.
The thing about capitalism is it pushes people into struggle, whatever the ideas in their heads, because of the nature of exploitation, of making people work longer and harder. Struggles break out whether or not the Socialist Worker Party are going to be here or not. But every time we've won gains in capitalism, they get rolled back, and therefore actually the conclusion will be to get rid of it totally.
So you do have an end vision in that sense.
Absolutely.
Which is get rid of it totally. Well, and so on. And very briefly, what do you do day by day?
Well, I mean, it depends what is going on in the world. It could mean going down to a picket line in the morning, raising solidarity for refugees and raising the question about opening the borders. Trotsky was an internationalist. We are. We think there should be no borders. You know, if capital can move around the world, actually refugees should be able to move. And so I've been to Calais on a convoy, but actually importantly brought that political message back. It's been part of those big demonstrations. It could mean going to a smaller meeting to plan out what people are going to be doing in their individual university. You know, there's a whole variety. The key is we're not sitting there in glorious isolation reading Trotsky. We use it as a guide to action.
John Callaghan, as somebody who's studied not just the Socialist Workers' Party, but the history of British Trotskyism, what's the difference between Trotskyism and what we might call the far left?
All Trotskyists have been associated with two propositions, and this is what makes them distinct among Marxists. The first proposition is that the Bolshevik Revolution went wrong around the time of the rise of the Stalin dictatorship, which essentially destroyed Soviet democracy, Communist Party democracy, and democracy within the Communist International. Anything Stalin did to transform the Soviet Union, say, with the five-year plans or collectivization, did not create a socialist society. The second proposition is that the experience of the Bolshevik Revolution is universally applicable. So Trotskyists have believed in the need for a Bolshevik-style party. They think that the transition to socialism will take place when possibly a situation of dual power arises.
Let's take those one at a time. A Bolshevik-style party, what does that mean?
Well, a Bolshevik-style party is essentially a party of activists, which sees itself as a vanguard. It doesn't have to be particularly large to be effective. The Bolsheviks at the beginning of 1917 had 20-something thousand members. And yet, obviously, they played a really big role in the events of October 1917 and seized power. So a vanguard party is what Trotskyists have sought to build. And they've sought to model that on Lenin's prescriptions,
which is pretty tight.
It's a centralised party. It's supposed to be democratic in the sense that people can debate things, but once the decision has been arrived at, the entire organisation is unified around that decision.
And everybody has to argue for that after the decision.
Absolutely, and especially people who opposed the position in the course of the debate.
Well, that creates a high level of discipline and coherence. And then you were talking about situations of dual power.
The really important thing there is the belief that workers' committees, workers' councils, or Soviets, as the Russians called them, would be a form of direct democracy. And this is another essential tenet of Trotskyism, that kind of direct democracy is far superior to anything that's possible in a parliamentary system. In fact, the parliamentary system is largely regarded as a sham.
Now, one of the things which anybody who thinks they know anything about Trotskyism thinks they know is that if you get two Trotskyist groups going into a unity conference, four come out. Has that been your experience of the history of Trotskyism?
That is the history of Trotskyism, a history of splits, factions, new organisations, new publications. There are always many Trotskyist organisations, certainly in Britain. Why is that? It's possibly because they have tried to combine a kind of Catholic regard for dogma with a kind of Protestant view of freedom of speech and the ability of people to make up their own minds. And it's a combination which leads people to take doctrine very seriously and then find themselves in principled opposition to others within the same organisation.
What have been the main Trotskyist organisations in recent British history?
Well, one time it was very easy to summarise. There was a unified organisation in 1944 called the Revolutionary Communist Party that had disappeared by 1949. From that came three tendencies, and they survived all the way through until the 1970s and 1980s.
So they become...
Well, they eventually become the Socialist Workers' Party in 1977, the Workers' Revolutionary Party, which I think was formed in 1973.
That was Vanessa Redgrave's party.
Jerry Healy was the main guru in that organisation, but Corinne and Vanessa Redgrave belonged to it as well. And the other one, of course, was what became known as the Militant Tendency, which began life as a very small group called the Revolutionary Socialist League, and they were practising what they called deep entrism.
Now, we'll come on to that in a moment. I just want to ask you about one other, which was big when I was a student, which is a group called the International Marxist Group. Whatever happened to them?
Well, the International Marxist Group achieved a certain profile primarily, I think, because of Tariq Ali, who was one of their leading members. And it played a significant role in the Vietnamese Solidarity Campaign in the 60s. And they managed to establish themselves at various universities. But I think at their peak in the mid-80s, the IMG only had about 350 members. And by that time, they'd accumulated something like a front organisation for every 11 members of the organisation. Since then, the whole idea of a unified Fourth International has rather gone away. Smaller groups have emerged from it, but many of the people who were associated with the IMG as leaders, like Tariq Ali, are now really only involved in Marxism in a kind of literary way through publications like the New Left Review.
Now, Michael Crick, John Callaghan there mentioned entrism and the origins of what you call the militant tendency. You wrote a book back in 1984 about militant. You were actually, I think, practically the first journalist to take militant in any way seriously. What actually is entryism, or deep entryism, as John Callaghan put it?
Well, it was a tactic developed by Trotsky in the 30s, whereby he argued that in Western social democratic parties, it was often in the interests of his followers that they were going to make more progress if they entered the mainstream social democratic or socialist party. They were going to recruit more, they were going to have more of a way of spreading their ideas. And indeed, in this country, at one time or another, I think all the strands of Trotskyism, if you go back far enough, have practiced this. And in particular, militant under a man called Ted Grant, who came over from South Africa and was a leading member of the Revolutionary Communist Party in the 1940s, practiced this policy within the Labour Party. Now, at various points, the other groups gave it up or were expelled. But militant, or the Revolutionary Socialist League, as it was originally known, continued this tactic through the 50s and 60s, not with much success at first.
Explain the tactic a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you actually do?
Well,
Did you say, hey, hi, I'm a member of the Revolutionary Socialist League?
No, not at all. Everything that militant did, or the Revolutionary Socialist League as it was before, was all the aspects of a political party, apart from standing in public elections. So you'd have organisers, you'd have policy, you'd have a national conference, you'd have local branches, you'd have a central committee, you'd have full-time staff, you'd have oodles of money. I mean, at one point, militant, in my estimation, around about the mid-1980s, was the fourth biggest political party. And they would operate secretly. So they'd have secret branches, a secret national conference, a secret central committee. And they denied totally they were an organisation. So they said, oh, all we are is supporters of a newspaper, the Militant, and you're being unfair on us. And it's only like other Labour Party newspapers, such as the Tribune newspapers. But in reality, Militant, as indeed the other Trotskyist groups in the past, were an extensive political party operating within the Labour Party to spread their ideas and recruit people to their cause.
Now, what did they achieve in their own terms at their zenith? I mean, how powerful were they? And I should just sort of declare a hand here. I was also a journalist in the period, and I remember travelling to Liverpool, where Derek Hatton, who was a famous member of Militant, was the deputy leader of Liverpool Council. And effectively, they ran the council there. Was that the biggest thing they ever got to do?
That and the anti-poll tax campaign a few years later. But in the mid-80s, Militant effectively ran Liverpool Council, and, you know, it was a huge story at the time. And yet, interestingly, Liverpool Council had, 99 councillors. There were probably only 12 members of Militant on the council. And the way they would operate is that the Militant people would agree their line amongst themselves, then they would go along to the broad left, and there'd be a few sort of sympathetic councillors as well.
The broad group of left-wingers.
Other left-wing councillors, maybe 25, 30 of them. The broad left would then agree the line put forward by Militant, and then the broad left group would go along to the full group of Labour councillors, say 50 or so, and they would then have a majority. So they would operate as a series of levers. And the thing about Militant, and indeed all Trotskyist groups, is they are brilliantly organised. They're great orators on the whole. They plan things. They know what they're doing. And they keep at it. They're committed. They put the hours in. They go to the meetings night after night after night. and they commit huge amounts of their own personal income, their lives really. It's like a religious cult in many ways.
And some of them became members of parliament.
Indeed. I mean, in the 1980s, there were three members of parliament elected from Millithen, and they managed to persuade local Labour parties to select them as candidates. And eventually the Labour Party, Pat Wall died while he was an MP, but the other two were thrown out of the Labour Party.
One of the things that happened at the time was that the Labour Party decided, some of us remember it well, some of us won't remember it at all, that they were going to expel Millithen because they were a party within a party. That's why it was said. And there was quite a campaign against it. And one of the leading members of the campaign against it was
Jeremy Corbyn. Before he was an MP, if you pick up a copy of the London Labour briefing from, I think it's sort of the autumn of 1982, and there's a little box, and it says, a campaign against the witch hunt, organiser Jeremy Corbyn, North London. There he was. And he was leading the fight for a while against the operation by Michael Foot and other Labour leaders to expel Millithen, and he was among those leading the resistance.
Now, are we to read from that the young Jeremy Corbyn actually was a sympathiser with Millithen, or was he just against doing things to other far-left wingers?
I don't think you can say Jeremy Corbyn is or was a Trotskyist. I mean, it's far too disorganised to be a Trotskyist, for one thing. But I suppose if you put it this way, does Jeremy Corbyn believe in parliamentary democracy, or would he like to overthrow capitalism and bring about transformation through a Bolshevik-style revolution? And I suppose the answer is about halfway between the two. I can't ever see Jeremy Corbyn leading a Bolshevik revolution. But on the other hand, if one was to occur, I think he'd probably be... I think he'd probably stand by and applaud.
I think at that time, Jeremy Corbyn was among those many people, actually, who thought there were no enemies on the left.
Emily, what's your view about this? One thing that has to be said is the Socialist Workers' Party has never actually practised entrism, at least I don't believe so. So you're obviously not in favour of that as a tactic.
No,
or a strategy.
The Labour Party pitches itself as a broad church, and we are absolutely for the right of socialists to be in the Labour Party. We're not seeking to join the Labour Party.
Well, why is that?
Well, we believe in actually having an independent revolutionary organisation. We think actually we can be more effective in that way. We constantly find points of unity with people in the Labour Party. We defend Corbyn against the right. We work with lots of Labour Party members over the question of anti-racism, for example.
But couldn't you work more closely with them if you were in there?
Well, that is a question. But for us, in the Socialist Worker Party, we wouldn't rule out anything in the future. I'd like to also be clear that if we were going to join the Labour Party, we would do it openly.
Let's come to the Tom Watson allegations, since it's actually the kind of the proximate reason why we're all sitting around this table. The claim he made essentially was that amongst all those young and other new members of the Labour Party, there were a number of Trotskyist organisations and people who were, in his phrase, kind of twisting the arms. And I think what he meant was exerting an influence beyond their numbers by their organisation, the sort of things that you were referring to earlier, Michael. John, is this actually credible?
I don't think it is, actually. I think if you look at what happened last year when the surge for Jeremy Corbyn first took place, there was a social media campaign. The rules made it very easy to join the Labour Party, to pay the £3 and to vote. Now, what that tells me, given that we're talking about something like 600,000 people, all told in the end, is that the price these individuals had to pay to become involved was very, very small. It wasn't like the activist Trotskyist organisation, which is making massive demands of the members. It was very easy.
So in that way, in that sense, it's kind of the antithesis.
It's absolutely the opposite, yeah. I mean, it's more akin to a flash mob.
Well, let's put this in some kind of context of numbers, Michael. How many Trotskyists, actually, do we imagine there are in Britain today?
Well, I mean, at its peak in the 80s, I think there were probably about 8,000 militant members. And that was probably the peak of Trotskyism in general. And if you added all the other Trotskyist groups together, you're probably talking about 20, 25,000 in all. I think probably now, if you added up all the little groups, and there's probably a dozen, 20 groups of one kind or another, you're probably talking about 3,000 or something. And, you know, a lot of that, well, the Socialist Workers' Party are not in Labour. You cannot explain that what's happening with Corbynism because of Trotskyists joining the Labour Party. Undoubtedly, there are some Trotskyists joining the Labour Party or rejoining the Labour Party or working their way back in or hoping to, but they do not explain this extraordinary phenomenon. It's become really the biggest mass party in this country since the war.
I'm ashamed to say, as a political correspondent who likes to think he's got, you know, some understanding of these things, I don't think anybody really understands what's going on with Corbynism within the Labour Party, even the people involved. But what I would say, the explanation is not Trotskyist centrism. It is happening, undoubtedly. And because Trotskyists are very well organised, their influence will be way beyond the pure numbers. But Momentum, the group that is the Corbyn fan club, the supporters club, is not another militant. It has some aspects of militant.
Yeah, I would just add that what you could call the organised core, Momentum and maybe some small Trotskyist groups, they will have ambitions for this. I mean, one of the things they'll be hoping to achieve is to change the terms of debate within the Labour Party. And to some extent, they've already succeeded.
And they turn up to all the meetings. You go to a Corbyn rally, they're all outside selling their papers.
Socialism was a word that wasn't used for many years. And interestingly, they see themselves as being people who are saving the Labour Party. They think the pre-Corbyn Labour Party, the dregs of what was the Blairite Labour Party, was actually taking Labour in a direction where it would have no purchase in certain parts of the country.
Well, I think it's fantastic that 600,000 people have joined the Labour Party and people are talking about socialist ideas. It reflects deep anger and bitterness in Britain, and actually similar processes are playing out in Europe, actually, when you look at the rise of Syriza or Podemos. In Britain, what's interesting is the alternative to the mainstream parties emerged within the Labour Party. I think, though, about this question of Trotskyists, I'll tell you what, apart from laughing at it, it's actually very disparaging about the people that are joining the Labour Party. They're too stupid to make up their own views. They have to be manipulated behind the scenes about wanting a left-wing alternative in this country.
It's also partly true that it's easier, and Michael in a way referred to it before, that if you don't understand what's happening and you haven't got a handle on it, it's easier to imagine that there's a small group behind it.
Well, I mean, we all love a conspiracy. Well, I do anyway. You know, as a political journalist, I'm always looking for them. But both in the 80s and now, it's in the interests of both sides to exaggerate. It's in the interests of the Trotskyists themselves to make it look like they're more influential than they are, and it's in the interests of their enemies to say, well, it's all a Trot plot. Now, as I said, there is an element of people joining the party, but it's a much wider phenomenon than that, as indeed it was in the 80s. You know, Bennism was an extraordinary development when Tony Benn very nearly became leader of the Labour Party, but it was a much wider group of people than followers of Leon Trotsky.
Amy Leather, are we through Corbyn and so on getting any closer to the socialist revolution that you've wanted for so long?
I think that it gives people more confidence that left-wing ideas are in the ascendancy. I talked about how we stand in the tradition of socialism from below. Actually, that opens up a discussion to be had. People joining because they support Corbyn want some sort of change.
But do you think they're potential revolutionaries?
I think everyone can be a potential revolutionary. Most of the time in society, most of us are told you have no power, only the people at the top have it. Actually, once you're on strike or on a protest or on a demonstration, you could get a sense collectively, when we act together, we're the majority in this country. But that can open up a bigger possibility of change that we're going to be part of discussing.
That's it from the briefing room this week, where our conclusion appears to be that whatever Corbynism is, Trotsky probably doesn't have much to do with it. My thanks to Amy Leather, John Callaghan and Michael Crick. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. It was produced by Joe Kent and Kirstine Knight and mixed by James Beard. Please rate our programme and review it on iTunes or whichever podcast provider you use, and get in touch, email us. We're thebriefingroom@bbc.co.uk. If you enjoyed our programme, you might also like listening to Analysis. That's another Radio 4 programme which also looks at forces and ideas that shape our world. See you next week.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. Bye.